The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. On today's program, coming up in the next segment, the second segment, we're going to be looking at the importance of prayer when it comes to your support for God's work. That's a subject, that last bit, that's a subject we've been discussing at length over the past week and a half, the support for God's work, and certainly our prayers for the work are a critical component of that support. Well, it's still been pretty busy around here at Edstone, and I'm sure at the headquarters campus in Edmond as well. We had the college graduation Sunday. Last night, they had the Imperial Academy graduation. That was in the middle of the night for us here at Edstone, but I did see some pictures that were tweeted out during and after that ceremony. So that's exciting to see that crop of high school seniors moving on. I think so many of them moving on to become college students at Armstrong College. My daughter's numbered among them. She's having a little get-together tonight here at Edstone. So the parties continue through this this busy week. Lots of socializing, lots of visitors still in town because of the graduation festivities. So we've been having some fun and also trying to do a fair bit of work as well. Yesterday, the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting because of the Israeli-Gaza border clash. This is really important for the UN to come together to try to figure this out and, of course, to condemn Israel, to use it as another excuse to condemn Israel. And in this particular case, they see the violence as something that relates directly to the U.S. embassy move to Jerusalem, which happened on Monday, and several European nations have come forward. Turkey, as I mentioned yesterday, of all nations, and then some of the Gulf states, they've come forward to condemn the embassy move and to basically blame the violence on Israel and the United States. And, of course, the media, the major media, they are there functioning as, for the most part, a propaganda arm for Hamas. Not just Hamas, really for all of America's enemies. But in this particular case, with this particular development, they're just an extension of the Hamas propaganda wing, which is why we really have to dig beneath the surface to get to the truth. What is refreshing, as I've noted this week, though, is to see an administration in the White House calling them out and exposing these lies and speaking the truth, because we're living at a time, as the prophet Isaiah said, when there's not going to be any truth. No one's pleading for the truth. That's the way God sees our society today. And it's not like it's, well, I mentioned digging. In some cases, it's not even that hard to get to the truth. There's a senior Hamas official commenting on the Gaza protests. This was at Memories, that outfit that translates a lot of the Arabic programming. But here's the senior Hamas official saying, this is not a peaceful resistance. It's supported by our weapons. That's Hamas saying, this isn't a demonstration. We've got weapons there. And then, and this is a direct quote, so when we talk about peaceful resistance, we are deceiving the public. That was on just a television program out there for everyone to see, translated by Memory and ignored by the mainstream media. When we say peaceful resistance, we're deceiving you. We're deceiving the public. We're deceiving the mainstream media. And of course, they want so much to believe Hamas that they're quite happy to be deceived. Well, the White House, as I said yesterday, they're laying the blame squarely on the Palestinian protesters, as they've been called, and they're not really Palestinian protesters. They're Hamas. It's organized and funded and supported by Hamas. The Hamas leader, he just made an appearance, I believe, yesterday. This was reported on the news last night. And those that were there at the border cheered him on. It's a military operation. It's an organized riot. Well, as I said, the UN Security Council called an emergency meeting yesterday to lay the blame on the United States and Israel, and the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations would have none of that. Nikki Haley, I mean, she stood up to that body as she's been as she's been doing often over the past 15 months, delivers this blistering speech, and then after she finishes her remarks, just before the Palestinian representative started in with his speech, she got up and left. She left the UN Security Council meeting. Pretty amazing. She was quick in her speech to point out the double standard that's, as she said, all too common.
And I will note that the double standard is all too common in this chamber and working overtime today.
It's just working overtime this week. They've got a lot to talk about. You've probably seen the stats before about how many times they come forward to condemn Israel for human rights violations of all things. The only fully functioning democracy in the Middle East where there's so much freedom, and yet the UN body, all that they can find wrong in this world, so much of it, half of it, more than half of it, it's confined to little Israel of all things. Here's what the U.S. ambassador went on to say in her speech yesterday at the UN, clip two.
Last week, Iranian forces attacked Israeli positions on the Golan Heights by launching rockets from Syria. This was a reckless provocation and escalation that must be stopped. It is an example of regional violence that should occupy our attention here in the Security Council. Also last week, Iranian proxy forces in Yemen launched missiles into Saudi Arabia. It was not the first time they have done it. This, too, is regional violence that should occupy our attention here in the Security Council. In recent days, Hamas terrorists, backed by Iran, have incited attacks against Israeli security forces and infrastructure. That is violence that should occupy our attention, too. The common thread in all of this is the destabilizing conduct of the Iranian regime.
That's the common thread. I mean, this is what's happening. Not years ago. This is last week and this week. This is Iran launching missiles into the Golan Heights, launching missiles into Saudi Arabia, and then funding these Hamas terrorists. That's who they're backed by, Iran. It's Iran inciting these attacks. And you see, America's enemies are especially angry because there's an administration, a Jeroboam administration in the White House that's exposing the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's exposing, to some degree, the King of the South. The reality, all of these things, as the ambassador said there, that this United Nations, this supposed peacekeeping organization, should be focusing on. That should be occupying their attention. Instead, they get together to denounce an embassy move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. What about the destabilizing presence of Iran in all of these nations in the Middle East? Ambassador Haley went on to say, clip three,
there is far too little discussion in the Security Council on Iran's destabilizing presence in Syria, its promotion of violence in Yemen, its support for terrorism in Gaza, and its dangerous and illegal weapons buildup in Lebanon.
Syria, Yemen, Gaza, Lebanon, and on it goes. And yet the radical left desperately wants to preserve the Iran nuclear deal. And what was it? President Trump, I mentioned it, I think, yesterday. He tweeted out on Sunday. I mean, look at what Iran was doing when the deal was in place. This is the real world. There's realists in the White House, at least some. The fantasists are gone. But this world we're in, their feet run to evil, Isaiah the prophet said. They make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Wasting and destruction are in their paths. That's the world today, and you see it in Syria, in Yemen, in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Paris. You see it all over the world. God said before the flood that our thoughts were on evil continually. And Jesus said it would be just like that in the last days. Clip 4 from yesterday.
For some people, the embassy opening is said to be a reason to engage in violence. How is that justified?
How is it justified? I mean, really, if you leave aside Gaza, where else are there any kinds of violent protests? You don't even see them in Ramallah or the West Bank. So far as I know, I mean, I haven't read all of the newspapers, but you don't see it throughout the Middle East. You just see it. You see it coming from Iran using its proxy, Hamas. Today they opened up the embassy in Guatemala, or at least they had the presentations there, the speakers, Benjamin Netanyahu, very similar to what happened Monday, only on a bigger scale Monday, but still a lot of enthusiasm and excitement at this reception. Prime Minister Netanyahu all smiles as he was speaking about the new Guatemalan embassy in Jerusalem. There's no protest, so far as I know, over that. See, really, the protest is over Israel's right to exist and America. Just a blind, obsessed hatred of America. The big Satan and the little Satan. Ambassador Haley said yesterday, this was, this so-called emergency meeting brought on by the UN Security Council. Here's clip 5.
As our president said when he announced the decision in December, the location of our embassy has no bearing on the specific boundaries of Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem or the resolution of contested borders. It has no bearing on Jerusalem's holy sites. It does not prejudge whatever the parties might negotiate in a peace agreement. It does not undermine the prospects for peace in any way. And yet, for some, this is supposedly a cause for violence.
Has nothing to do with the peace process, she brings out. And President Trump made sure to point that out in December. It's just the United States declaring the obvious, an obvious truth, that Israel, as an established state on earth today, choosing where it wishes to put its headquarters or its capital, the United States is just acknowledging that. But notice what her speech yesterday it leads to. Well, first, before I get to the real whopper, here's clip 6.
I asked my colleagues here in the Security Council, who among us would accept this type of activity on your border? No one would. No country in this chamber would act with more restraint than Israel has. In fact, the records of several countries here today suggest they would be much less restrained.
That's Nikki Haley pointing out the truth. Nations like Turkey, they would have much less restraint if this was going on at their border with Syria, for example. In fact, Israel has exercised all kinds of restraint. I mean, they're sending drones to the border and dropping canisters of tear gas to try to keep these terrorists from cutting their way through the Israeli fence. I mean, that's a lot of restraint. And even as far as casualties go, I mean, in a lot of cases, we're taking Hamas's word for it. But listen to Ambassador Haley as she gets right to the heart of what really this is all about. Here's one final clip, clip 7.
Those who suggest that the Gaza violence has anything to do with the location of the American embassy are sorely mistaken. Rather, the violence comes from those who reject the existence of the State of Israel in any location.
That's what it's really about. It's not about the location of an embassy. It's about the location of Israel. And those who would not accept the existence of an Israeli state. This is what she said yesterday before getting up and walking out of the Palestinian representative speech. It's a new direction for the United States, that's for sure. The 8 years previous to this current administration, I mean, they thought of every possible fault of Israel for these kinds of, I mean, Hamas has been doing this thing for years. It's been even in this most recent protest, this most recent organized riot. It's the culmination of 8 weeks. 8 weeks of violence there at the border. Funded by, supported by Iran. Well, she concluded her speech congratulating Israel on its birthday, its 70th anniversary, and just the remarkable achievement of Israel since its independence 70 years ago. And Ambassador Haley referenced the prophet Isaiah, saying that the people of Israel have been a vision of light unto the nations. She said, may the next 70 years be ones of strength, of hope, and peace. She said that after referencing the prophet Isaiah's vision of a light unto the nations. You can look through the prophet Isaiah's book and see dozens of references to light, including in chapter 59 and the chapter that follows, chapter 59, the chapter we have referenced a lot with respect to peace and the fact that man doesn't know the way to peace. He doesn't know. It's like Herbert Armstrong said in his book, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, governments promise peace, but they bring wars. That's the reality. Look, we should be talking about Iran's destabilizing influence in this region. Syria, Yemen, Gaza, Lebanon. That's what we should be talking about. There's wars. I mean, we can get here and talk about peace and put blame on Israel or the United States, but look at what's happening. Everyone says they want peace. You have diplomats who are out there working hard for peace, pleading for peace. And yet there is no peace. And you can see why right here from the book of Isaiah, just to focus in on the book that Ambassador Haley did. There's a lot of positives. There's a lot of positives in this book. But they have to do or center around the coming kingdom of God and the establishment of peace on this earth. With respect to the world today, the prophet says, the way of peace they know not. As Mr. Armstrong said, when we take a hard, cold, realistic view of conditions and trends, they do point inevitably to a fast approaching world crisis of combined nuclear war, starvation, uncontrollable disease epidemics, crime and violence, and the extinction of human life on this planet. If you take a hard, cold, realistic view, if you just look through the stack of news that I get put on my desk each day, this is the world today. Now there's hope. The hope is for the better world to come. But in the world today, the prophet says, we grope for the wall like the blind, and we grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday as in the night. Even when the light from the sun lights up our earth, our planet, we still stumble around aimlessly. We don't know our way, as the prophet Jeremiah added. We don't know the way to direct our own steps. As I say, though, there is hope, and it's brought out even at the end of this passage. Verse 20 talks about the Redeemer shall come to Zion, and unto them that turn from transgression in Jacob, says the Eternal, here is the hope. And then carrying on into the next chapter, Isaiah 60 in verse 1 says, arise, arise, shine, for your light is come. And the glory of the Eternal is risen upon you. The immediate future for our people, for our nations, is very dark. But Jesus Christ is light. And because of his return, we do have a radiant future ahead of us. Verse 2 of the same chapter says, for behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people, but the Eternal shall arise upon you, and his glory shall be seen upon you. This is talking about the soon coming kingdom of God, the wonderful world of tomorrow, when the first fruits will be born into God's family, and when that family of radiating spirit beings will indeed be a light unto the nations. It says in verse 3, and the Gentiles shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. When we come back, we'll talk about the importance of prayer when it comes to your support for God's work. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. One may blind his eyes to existing facts and trends and say the world cannot get any worse than it already is. Or, if we just ignore the conditions and don't worry, perhaps they'll go away. But these conditions and trends won't just go away. Not unless they are caused to go away. The scriptures of the Holy Bible, the inspired revelation of the Supreme God, have foretold today's world conditions and trends, and give us the advance news of coming peace on earth, of universal prosperity, of happiness and joy, of veritable utopia. This is the good news of the world tomorrow, and it is absolutely sure. This coming world is vividly described in our booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow. What it will be like. Bible prophecy explains in detail how God will intervene to save mankind from destroying himself. Jesus Christ will return to earth, putting an end to the rule of man and restore God's government on earth. To learn much more about this prophesied utopia, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Herbert Armstrong noted in one of his old coworker letters that the contribution that coworkers make, it's vitally important for the growth and the development of God's work, and it's something that some can underestimate, as he said in that letter. There is a lot that coworkers and donors and members can and should do in support of God's work. You think about the financial support brought on by all of those contributors, putting it together. I mean, that's what enables this work to go forward and to work with all of the tools that God makes available. But together with that financial support and being an example to the world, or letting your light shine, like I said in the first segment, there is, of course, the contribution that we can all make in praying for God's work, praying for God's kingdom to come. The Bible says the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. I mean, it accomplishes a lot. And God knows what the work needs. He knows what we need, even before we ask for it. And yet God wants us to ask. God wants us to ask with fervency. He wants us to be a praying people. Pray daily, the prayer outline says. Or as the Apostle Paul said in 1 Thessalonians, pray without ceasing. Don't ever get out of the habit of effectual, fervent prayer. Mr. Armstrong would often talk to God's people and ask them, look, if the work of God's church today was based on your prayers alone, how effective would that work be? Well, there's thousands praying, but what if it was just you? What if the work was just relying on your prayers, your spiritual offerings? How far would the work go? How much would the work be able to expand and grow? I want to look at an example here in the book of Daniel. This really is an amazing chapter about prayer. Of course, when you think of the book of Daniel, you generally think of all of these earth-shaking prophecies, the Daniel 2 image, the beasts of Daniel 7, the Daniel 8 man, the Daniel 11 clash, the countdown to Christ's return there in Daniel 12, numbering days. I mean, this is a prophetic book, if ever there was one. But there's also a lot in the book of Daniel about Christian living, about prayer, about obedience, about fasting, about Bible study. Here in Daniel 6, we see the prophet Daniel. He had been promoted to the third most powerful position in the Medo-Persian Empire. The third most powerful position, this Jewish lad. And Darius, well, he put 120 princes over the kingdom, and then he had three presidents right at the top over these 120 princes, and Daniel was right at the top among all of them. Verse 3, this is Daniel 6, it says, Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. I mean, practically over the kingdom, the number two man. Tremendous favor from God, from this Gentile king. And of course, this aroused a lot of jealousy among those other princes in the royal court. And they came after Daniel. Verse 4 says, Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. And then said these men, We shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God. So they went after his religion. They were looking for anything they could find on Daniel. They were looking for it was like a setup from the start. This illegal investigation to go after this faithful man. Verse 6 says, Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said thus unto him, King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdoms and governors and princes, counselors, captains, I mean everybody who was anybody. We've consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of you, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. And verse 8 says, "Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing, that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which alter not." Wherefore, King Darius signed the writing and the decree. So here there was a law enacted that officially banned prayer for an entire month, 30 days. This was the state, the Medo-Persian Empire, banning prayer. And Daniel, as I say, was a leading administrator in that state, in that kingdom. And he was also a very prayerful man. He prayed to his God three times a day. And so here comes this ban on prayer, and of course, anyone who violated this law would be condemned to death. They would be cast alive into a den of hungry lions. And guess what Daniel did the moment that he heard about this ban on prayer? Well, he immediately went home and he prayed to the great Creator God. Verse 10, it says, "Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day, and he prayed, and he gave thanks before his God, as he did all the time." He didn't adjust his behavior one bit. There's a verse in Acts 5 that says we ought to obey God rather than men, and that's what he was doing here. As high ranking as he was in the Medo-Persian Empire, Daniel's allegiance first was to Almighty God, first and foremost. He observed the first commandment. That decree, that ban on prayer, did not alter Daniel's prayer routine one bit. In fact, it probably electrified his prayers with just that much more fervency. Now, when you think about all of the trivial things or the lame excuses that hinder our prayer lives, think about the distractions, the discouragement, the laziness, the drowsiness, the busyness, the skewed priorities. This is pretty corrective, this passage, Daniel 6. I mean, when you think about this great prophet of God, he was physical, flesh and blood, human being, just like we are, and yet he wouldn't even let a prayer ban and the threat of death interfere with his prayer life. I think it's safe to say that prayer really meant a lot to the prophet Daniel. And I think the other thing that's amazing about verse 10 there, Daniel's reaction to this decree, is that he dropped to his knees. He went to his home, he dropped to his knees, and he immediately started to give God thanks. That's really amazing. To maintain that kind of grateful, thankful spirit, even when your life was threatened. Notice how he remained so positive and so hopeful, even in the midst of a fiery trial. It's the same story as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from earlier in the book. But just to focus on this example, think about how important prayer was to the prophet Daniel. To Daniel, his prayer before God, his daily prayer life, was his life. That's what his life revolved around. Daniel's prayers meant more to him than even his own physical existence. That's what Daniel 6 is showing. And as I say, you see this example, and it's impossible not to be corrected by this when you think about how many times we're distracted away from doing what we should be doing. How important is your prayer life to you? Does your prayer life mean as much to you as it did to Daniel? Would you rather die than give up your prayer life? Would you rather die than give up your prayer life even for just 1 month? Daniel could have easily reasoned here. Well, you know, it is 30 days and it's outside my control. I don't want to die. I mean, I wouldn't be of much service to God if I died. So I'll just ride this one out. Or at the very least, I'll close all my windows so that nobody sees it. I'll just do it in secret. He didn't do that. He just carried on as he had always done. Three times, and they knew it, his enemies. They knew he was a God-fearing man. They knew he loved to communicate with his God. And that's why they went after him on this point. There's another example over in 1 Samuel 1. I think I have time. If you're reading along with me, you can hold your place in Daniel. We'll come back to Daniel 6 at the end. But in 1 Samuel 1, this is the story of Hannah and her prayers to God. I mean, she was so emotionally charged, so fervent in her prayers to God that Eli thought she was drunk. And you know the story here, the background, the contentions between Hannah and Peninnah, these two wives of Elkanah. And verse 7 says, "And as he did so year by year when she went up to the house of the Eternal, so she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat." It was a real sore trial for Hannah. But notice how this impacted her prayer life. It says in verse 9, "So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh, and after they had drunk. Now Eli, the priest, sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of the Eternal, and she was in bitterness of soul, and prayed unto the Eternal, and wept sore." She wept sore during her prayers. This was not some kind of sleepy time prayer. This was not a half-hearted attempt to talk to God. She cried out to God. And she vowed a vow, verse 11 says, "O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your handmaid and remember me and not forget your handmaid, but will give unto your handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Eternal all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head." So she made this vow to God that if he opened her womb, if she was blessed with a baby boy, that she'd give that boy to God. I mean, this was an extreme course of action to take. She was willing to do it, though. It says in verse 13, "Now Hannah, she spoke in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli thought she had been drunken. He said to her, 'How long will you be drunk? Put away your wine from you.' And Hannah," verse 15, "answered and said, 'No, my Lord, I'm a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I've drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Eternal.'" You see, she was just a normal flesh and blood woman, just like Daniel was, a normal flesh and blood man. But these were God-fearing human beings who spoke often to God with sincerity, with emotion. Well, you know the story. She eventually did get pregnant, and she had a son, and his name was called Samuel, which means heard of God. That's the meaning of the name Samuel. God heard her prayer. He heard Hannah's energetic, effectual, fervent prayers. She wept sore. How important was prayer to Hannah? She prayed to God, "Father, I'll give you my very own long-waited-for son if you provide me with one, if you open my womb." And you see this sequence of events and see how her relationship with God was more important than her flesh and blood son, this son that she longed for. She gave him up. What a sacrifice. There's lots, of course, that we can take away from these examples. I mean, think about not just how important prayer is, but think about the energy and the fervency that we bring to our prayer life. God is not going to intervene in our lives or for the work if we're offering up prayers that we don't even see as that important ourselves? Is God going to respond to our prayers if we don't place our relationship with God right at the top of our priority list? My father wrote years ago that our primary focus in life must be on how we talk to God in prayer. He said that is our number one priority. That needs to be our focus. That's our primary focus. That's our number one priority. And the thing about it is, the higher the value that we place on prayer, the more fervent and energetic those prayers are going to be automatically. I mean, you see that with any other pursuit in life. If it's not something that's really important to you, are you really going to put your heart into it? But if you make prayer the most important activity of the day, then it automatically ups the fervency level, the energy level, the emotion level. And of course, the more effectual and the more fervent that prayer offering is, the more swift and dramatic God's response will be. So important that we pour our hearts into it. As I say, the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. I gave the example recently in class of William Howe. He headed up the British forces in Boston at the time of the Revolution, early on in the Revolution. And in this book we read about 1776 by David McCullough, it talked about William Howe just being more interested in the comforts and pleasures of life. And so he wasn't really eager to go and fight against General Washington. But yet he had a better trained army. He had more experience. But with General Washington, I mean, his heart was in it. And he wanted to know everything about Howe and all the other British generals so that he could draw up a strategy and so that he could confront the enemy. But Howe was too passive. He was too slow moving. It wasn't number one priority for him. And I think that had a little something to do with the outcome of that war. Well, God had a lot more to do with it. It was a fulfillment of prophecy, as we well know. But God had a lot to do with those individuals that were the key players in that history as well. The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. That same passage in James, by the way, it talks about Elijah being a man subject to like passions as we are. He had similar drives and desires like we do, but his prayer life, I mean, that's what really set him apart. Elijah cried out to God, "Hear me! Hear me, God!" And God heard him. His relationship with God was more important than even his own physical life. Mr. Armstrong, an end-time Elijah type, he said in 1980 that he couldn't think of one thing that he had to rely on God for and ask him for in prayer that has not been answered. He couldn't think of one area, one request. And yet at the same time, he said he couldn't think, I don't have this exact quote with me, but that God would never answer a prayer if it was, you know, half-hearted, if it was a sleepy time prayer. When you think about the ultimate example, Jesus Christ, and the way that he prayed, the book of Hebrews says that he offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears. Jesus Christ prayed boldly. He prayed energetically. He prayed fervently. On one occasion, he sweat great drops of blood while praying. That's the way he prayed. Jesus Christ's primary focus in life was how he talked to God in prayer. It was that important. Now, we're here to build the kind of prayer life that Christ had, that Daniel had, that Hannah had, that Elijah had. And Christ will help us in that. You can read the last part of Hebrews 4, where it says we have this great high priest, Jesus Christ, the Son of God. He's our advocate, 1 John 2 says. He's our intercessor, it says over in Romans 8. He's interceding on our behalf. He's at the right hand of God. Paul said in Hebrews, come boldly before that throne then and obtain mercy. Find grace to help in time of need. See, we have to go boldly before God. Back to Daniel 6. Let's just finish our study over here in the sixth chapter of Daniel, as I say, pretty amazing chapter about the importance of prayer. Imagine prayer being so important in your life that you would not let anything interrupt it, not even a prayer ban, a statute going out saying, if you pray today, you're going to die. You're going into a den of hungry lions. This is from a Tomorrow's World article. This is back in 1971, going back to, again, this point about how effectual and fervent it is. It says in this piece, effective prayers are not merely mental gymnastics or intellectual exercise. They're not necessarily replete with detailed logical arguments. I mean, all of that's good as well. But it makes the point here, they are heartfelt and fervent. See, there's nothing wrong with logic and detail. But even those things aren't going to amount to much if we don't have the fervency and the zeal behind our prayers. Well, here I see in my notes this quote from Mr. Armstrong, the one I paraphrased earlier, and not so well, I now see. He said, I have never known of a real answer coming from God of a casual routine prayer. See, it can't just be casual and routine if we're expecting to get an answer. This example here in Daniel 6, verse 10 again, it says, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks to God as he had always done. Daniel was in grave danger. And yet he went into his prayer closet and he began thanking God for his many blessings. Well, what happened? Verse 11 says, then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. So it was a conspiracy from the beginning. They had it in for him from the start. So they went and told on him. They told King Darius. And of course, the king was he was devastated by this news. Verse 14, it says, then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored until the going down of the sun to deliver him. This is an amazing aspect of this story as well. Just the reaction coming from King Darius. He thought all day long about how he could get Daniel out of this fix that he was in. Verse 15 says, then these men assembled unto the king and said to the king, know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is, or what that law is, that no decree nor statute which the king establishes may be changed. I mean, they were really concerned about upholding the law so long as it called for Daniel's life. Really, it was these corrupt counselors, that should have been punished. Well, that's eventually what happens, in fact. But they were just in it for their own self-interest. They weren't really in it to serve the king. Daniel was, and the king knew it. Notice what the king ended up doing. Verse 16, it says, then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spoke and said to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. I mean, that's King Darius. That's the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. He's well aware of Daniel's God and the fact that Daniel served his God continually. This is a carnal Gentile king. I mean, I don't think you could say he was the most spiritually minded man in the world at that time, but he understood enough to know that making prayer your primary focus in life gets results. He knew that Daniel worshiped a God who was strong enough to deliver him from this trial. That's incredible. Verse 17, and a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. And then verse 18, another incredible verse. It says, then the king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. Neither were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. He was up all night long fasting and presumably praying. Praying for God's prophet. He supported God's man, and God honored him for doing that. He heard about all these other miracles that God had performed through Daniel. So why wouldn't God deliver him from a den of angry lions, of hungry lions? Verse 19, it says, then the king arose very early in the morning, and went in haste unto the den of lions. And when he had come to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, is your God whom you serve continually able to deliver you from the lions? And then said Daniel unto the king, O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel and has shut the lions' mouths, and they have not hurt me. For as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before you, O king, have I done no hurt. Do you think the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much? Well, look at what my father has to say in the Daniel Unlocks Revelation book sometime. The main focus in that booklet is on his three friends, or at least with respect to looking to God and the relationship that they had with God and the faith that those three friends had. These men were thrown into the fiery furnace. Daniel was thrown into the den of lions. And the point that my father makes in that booklet is that we need to have contact with God and faith in God before the trial, during the trial, all the way through the trial. He says God didn't remove the trial. He led them through it. These were faithful men. These were ordinary men who had extraordinary prayer lives. And God just led them right through the trial. He tested them. He tried them. He took them right into the furnace or right into the lion's den. And then he brought them out. Verse 23, it says, then was the king exceeding glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him because he believed in his God. He believed in God. What kinds of prayers do you suppose he offered when he was in that den? I bet they were effectual and fervent. Verse 24 says, and the king commanded that they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, their wives, and the lions had the mastery of them, and broke all their bones in pieces, or ever they came at the bottom of the den. You see, vengeance is God's. Daniel just let God solve this problem. And what's incredible is so did Darius. He cast him into the den and then said, your God will save you. Don't worry. Verse 25, then King Darius wrote unto all the people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever, and his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed. and his dominion shall be even unto the end. See, you get to the end of the story, and you see that the tables had completely turned. What started as a 30-day ban on prayer turned into a kingdom-wide decree that everyone tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. What a miraculous turnaround. And this all revolved around Daniel's prayer life. Verse 28 says, "So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian." Daniel's life, it really does reveal the power and the effectiveness of fervent prayer. He was an ordinary man who prophesied about the successive world-ruling empires. He was taken into slavery, and yet he trusted God to lead him through his trials. And look at how God promoted him. Look at how men that Daniel worked under promoted him. He prospered under all of these empires because of his prayer life. What a book, the book of Daniel. What a chapter, Daniel 6. Go back and look at Daniel Unlocks Revelation if you'd like to study into particularly that example with the fiery furnace. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send in some comments about prayer or some requests or feedback on anything in general, you can send that to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.